This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 31st of August, these are our main stories. An investigation by BBC Arabic has found evidence of war crimes being committed in Syria during a recent airstrike. Russia denies involvement. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has warned that MPs trying to block a no-deal Brexit could actually make it more likely. And Hurricane Dorian has gathered strength as it heads towards Florida, and residents stock up on essentials. Also in this podcast, the outlook for the Great Barrier Reef has been downgraded from poor to very poor, but hope isn't lost.
With the right mix of local actions and global actions to tackle climate change, we can provide a better outlook and future for the Great Barrier Reef.
And chocolate as a way to encourage racial harmony? What happens when brands try to tackle the big issues? Nearly 40 people were killed in an attack on a Syrian market last month, and an investigation by BBC Arabic has found evidence that it was a war crime. Simon Cox is the investigations editor for BBC Arabic, and he told us what they found.
We were looking at an attack on a market in a place called Marat al-Numan, with 39 people killed, and it was the deadliest attack in this recent offensive by the Syrian government and the Russians that's been going on since April. And there had been lots of questions about, was this actually an attack on a market? Because the Russian military always said it didn't happen. If it was, what kind of attack? And then, most importantly, who carried out the attack? So we were looking at those three elements and trying to see what we could add and if we could come up with any significant answers, really.
And what did you find?
First of all, we looked at video footage that had been sent to us and that we'd found to try and pinpoint exactly where this strike took place. And what we'd found was we'd looked at some of the footage and then we'd look at satellite images and then using geolocation and a bit of mapping, we'd pick out significant places and then find our location. And through that, we found it was definitely in a street market in the middle of this town. Residential area, you know, we looked at lots and lots of images, lots of maps around the area, no obvious military presence. And then the other important point was this idea of that there had been more than one strike. So one of the videos we had been sent was someone who'd gone along. They were alerted to the first explosion, went out, and then while they were there, they saw a plane circling back and then this second missile strike.
It's hit again. The plane has hit the same spot again.
What's important about that clip that you've just played is this is what's known as a double tap attack. And what this is when a plane targets an area and then waits until civilians, first responders go in and then attacks it again. And that is a war crime under international law.
And what is Russia saying?
So what Russia has said is they held a very elaborate press conference a week after this attack at the end of July. And they showed video footage where they said, look, there was no attack. There's a perfectly calm, functioning market. Now, we had looked at that video footage and there were several that they'd showed. And it was indeed a market. It was a wholesale market, but it was 350 metres away from the street market that was targeted. Now, we had put specific questions to them because we had spoken to a network of secret plane trackers who work inside Idlib. They monitor the communications of pilots and then decipher the codes and then issue warnings. And they had noticed a plane that had taken off at 8:30 in the morning, a Russian plane with a Russian call sign. And then 10 minutes later, there was a bombing in Marat al-Numan.
That was Simon Cox, investigations editor for BBC Arabic. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says attempts to block a no-deal Brexit risk taking away his trump card in negotiations with the EU. Efforts to stop him from proroguing Parliament next month have moved to the courts. His critics say the five-week suspension is an attempt to prevent the Commons heading off no-deal. He says it will allow his government to set out its new legislative agenda. In a BBC interview, Mr Johnson said it was important the EU knows he's serious.
As long as they think in the EU that Parliament might try to block Brexit, or might even succeed in blocking Brexit, the less likely they are to give us the deal we want. The weird thing is that the more the parliamentarians try to block the no-deal Brexit, the more likely it is that we'll end up in that situation.
Our political correspondent Helena Wilkinson told us more about Mr. Johnson's approach.
We know that Boris Johnson announced a couple of days ago he was going to suspend Parliament for about 5 weeks. And this caused a huge amount of anger amongst those, the opposition, members of the opposition, some Tory rebels as well, who basically are saying that it lessened or shortened the number of days that they would be able to sit in Parliament and discuss Brexit. Now, Downing Street said that's not true. There will be enough days for MPs to talk about Brexit in the House of Commons. But what Boris Johnson has said today, he's basically saying, look, if we end up in a situation where we leave the EU without a deal, it's not going to be my fault. It's going to be the fault of the MPs who were trying to oppose it.
Now, in the meantime, there are lots of challenges to the prorogation of Parliament. Where are we with the legal challenges?
Yeah, so aside from all of the negotiations that are going on at the moment and also the MPs who are trying to bring about, we think, next week, new legislation to try and force Boris Johnson to ask for an extension from the European Union, there are also legal challenges going on. So there has been a legal challenge in a court in Scotland, and today they ruled there that they couldn't have an emergency injunction, if you like, on the suspension of Parliament that Boris Johnson announced. And that's what those who are taking the case to the court are saying. They think it's unlawful that Boris Johnson is suspending Parliament. But that hearing is going to be heard in full next week. And separately, there's another legal challenge, but again, the same. A group of people, including a businesswoman called Gina Miller, she is taking Boris Johnson to court, if you like, for him suspending Parliament. And today we heard also from the former Conservative Prime Minister, Sir John Major. He has said he is going to piggyback, if you like, onto this court case. He's going to join Gina Miller because he thinks that it is wrong that Boris Johnson is going to suspend Parliament. So you've got this quite incredible situation where you've got a former Conservative Prime Minister taking the current Conservative Prime Minister to court.
That was Helena Wilkinson. As we record this podcast, people in the Bahamas and the US state of Florida are preparing for yet another hurricane as Dorian makes its way across the Caribbean and gathers strength. It's expected to become a Category 4 hurricane by the weekend, the second highest category there is, with wind speeds of over 200 kilometres an hour. A state of emergency has been declared in Florida, and the state governor, Ron DeSantis, urged residents to stock up on supplies to last at least a week.
We urge all Floridians to have 7 days worth of food, medicine, and water. This is potentially a multi-day event where it will churn slowly across the state. That obviously creates a whole host of issues.
People in Florida seem to be taking that warning seriously, as CBS reporter David Begnaud explains.
We are in Merritt Island, Florida, which is just outside of Orlando. People are waiting in line right now to get sandbags. Yesterday, they waited for more than 8 hours. Today, people showed up before 6 a.m. Sandbags were going to be distributed at 8 a.m., but a couple people brought their own shovels, grabbed the bags that the police left over, and are now serving themselves. You can understand why, as people prepare for what is expected to be a major hurricane. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has told people, prepare now. Do not wait until the weekend. And they want people to prepare not only with sandbags, but also with food, water, and fuel. We've seen lines for gasoline stretching blocks and even for a half mile. Shelves at various stores are empty, specifically the shelves for things like bread and water. In fact, some grocery stores are telling people that you're limited to 4 cases of water per family. I should tell you this. No one seems to be panicking here in the state of Florida. Everyone is calm, but heeding the warning from the governor to get ready now.
CBS reporter David Begnaud in Florida. Now, for many countries, a growth of 5% would be celebrated, but for India, it's the country's lowest rate in more than 6 years. In the same period last year, GDP grew by 8%. So how will the government deal with it? Our business reporter in India, Suranjana Tiwari, has more.
This data comes as no big surprise, although it was lower than the 5.7% that most experts were expecting. The signs of a slowdown are everywhere. Sales of cars, motorbikes, soap and biscuits are all down. Investment is declining and people are losing their jobs. In the last week, the government's announced a host of measures to try and revive growth. They include relaxed norms on foreign investment, and in the last few hours, the finance ministry announced a merger of public sector banks in order to try and help the financial health of those banks that are struggling with bad loans. Experts say the measures haven't gone far enough yet. They say taxes need to be cut in order to put more money in the pockets of people who will then spend, and that will then create jobs and impact growth as well. For now, these figures are very alarming, especially during the same quarter last year, India was growing at 8%. So the fact that it's now growing at 5% is going to be of great concern to many people here.
Suranjana Tiwari. Fans in Ivory Coast are bidding farewell to the celebrated singer DJ Arafat, who was killed in a motorcycle accident earlier this month. The performer's real name was Ange Didier Huanon, and he was 33 years old. His funeral is taking place in Abidjan on Saturday, and on Friday, a musical tribute attracted large crowds. He was known as the King of Coupe Décalé, the style of music he made famous. Let's have a listen to one of his biggest hits, Enfant Béni. And here are some of his fans talking about his legacy.
He himself once said that we should come celebrate his life when he dies. So here we have come in big numbers.
We've lost someone so dear to us. We are the Ivorian youth, and Arafat was part of us. And we are very proud to be here today to pay him his last homage.
More on the day's events from our reporter in Abidjan, Hatuma Diara.
There is thousands of DJ Arafat's fans which have already gathered. They came with their T-shirt with the name of DJ Arafat. They are already dancing and waiting for the artist to produce and to perform. There is a lot of policemen too to avoid any incident. 10,000 policemen have been deployed and some military in order to avoid any crowd movement, because a lot of people have been running to come into the stadium, which has only 35,000 capacity. So everybody will not have the chance to be seated because 200,000 people are expected today.
DJ Edu presents Destination Africa on BBC Radio 1 Extra. And he explained to Peter Akwache what made DJ Arafat so successful.
His uniqueness came from him pushing a genre that was absolutely unknown from the French-speaking countries of Africa, and him being almost like refreshing that genre of music, coupe décalé, so to speak, which is, you know, like one of the biggest sounds to come out of francophone-speaking and French-speaking countries of Africa.
Mm. And I know he was big in francophone Africa, as you say, and he was also big in France. Did he cut across to anglophone Africa as well?
Yes, later on he managed to do that through collaborations with people like Davido, you know, the Fally Ipupas, the Koffi Olomides. So the crossover and him being one of the first people to do that made him quite popular. And also doing reggae and speeding up Coupe Décalé, collaborating with people like Naza recently, who was number one on my show from DRC Congo, just made him more popular because he was reaching out throughout the continent.
DJ Edu was speaking to Peter Akwache. Still to come on this podcast, if you are a well-presented man who likes fancy dress, then keep listening for a job opportunity which might be right up your street on the island of St. Helena. Hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, is used to treat the symptoms of menopause. It was already known that its side effects included an increased risk of developing breast cancer. But a new study by researchers at the University of Oxford says the danger of developing breast cancer from taking HRT lasts more than a decade after treatment stops. And that means the risk is double that which women are currently being told. They estimate the therapy could have caused over 1 million cases of breast cancer in the West since the 1990s. However, Dr. Louise Newson is cautious about this new research. She is a general medical practitioner and an expert in treating menopausal symptoms. She told Julian Marshall more about those symptoms.
To be officially menopausal, a woman has to not have her period for a year. But a lot of women have perimenopausal symptoms, so when their periods change in nature or frequency and they start to develop symptoms. There can be physical symptoms, so such as night sweats, hot flushes, migraines, urinary symptoms, joint pains, muscle aches. But then, more importantly, for the women that I see in my clinic are the psychological symptoms, such as low mood, anxiety, poor memory, reduced concentration, low motivation. People just feel the shell of what they used to be. But also, we have an increased risk of really important diseases such as heart disease, osteoporosis, type 2 diabetes, dementia. HRT is one part of treatment. There are different types, different doses of HRT, but it's also looking at diet, it's looking at exercise, looking at alcohol intake, sleep. So there's a whole array of treatments that should be discussed and assessed when we think about helping menopausal women. So HRT usually contains estrogen, which is the main hormone that reduces and goes as we go through the menopause. So giving the hormones back will improve symptoms. But also, more importantly for me as a physician, is it will reduce future risk of all those diseases that I mentioned. And so the guidelines are very clear that for the majority of women, the benefits of taking HRT outweigh any risks, and also that HRT can be taken in the long term.
And you're not thinking again as a result of this new research?
No, I'm not. And when I first read the press release, obviously it's scary and you think, oh my goodness, maybe I should be taking my HRT patch off. But when I've read the article, we've known for a long time that some types of HRT are associated with a small risk of breast cancer, but it's still a small risk. This study has shown the risk might be slightly higher in some types and some women, but it doesn't show a cause and effect. It also doesn't show there's an increased risk of death from breast cancer. And the commonest reason why women get breast cancer and any cancer is due to obesity. So we need to weigh up the benefits versus the risks. The guidelines don't need to change. For a lot of women, HRT makes a huge difference.
That was Dr. Louise Newson. It's one of the seven wonders of the natural world and the planet's biggest single structure made by living organisms. But the future of the Great Barrier Reef looks very bleak. The Australian government agency that manages the reef has downgraded its outlook from poor to very poor and says rising sea temperatures caused by climate change pose the most serious threat. The reef off the coast of northeastern Australia covers nearly 362,000 square kilometres. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
The Great Barrier Reef is the largest structure ever made by life on Earth. It's the length of the entire west coast of the US. It's the most biodiverse habitat in the oceans. The reef has been valued as worth at least £30 billion a year in food, livelihoods from tourism, fisheries and even medicines to treat cancer, Alzheimer's disease, arthritis and heart disease. Today's report states that pollution, an increase in the number of starfish which feed on coral and are boosted by nutrients in the pollution, and a rise in sea temperatures are continuing to wipe out coral and destroy habitats for other sea life. The chief scientist at the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, Dr. David Wackenfeld, said that the reef's problems were largely driven by climate change, but said that all was not yet lost.
With the right mix of local actions to improve the resilience of the system and global actions to tackle climate change in the strongest and fastest way possible, we can turn that around and we can provide a better outlook and future for the Great Barrier Reef and the great economic and social values that it provides for Australia and indeed for the world.
Local actions involve reducing pollution, which will also reduce the starfish infestations. But what's also required is concerted global action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that an increase in average global temperatures of 2 degrees would result in a world without coral, and so a loss of the medicines, food, income and jobs it provides. Keeping temperature rises to within that level is possible, its scientists said, but would require rapid and drastic cuts in emissions.
Palab Ghosh. Kenya has begun collecting data for its latest census, and it's the first country in Africa and the second in the world to recognise people who are intersex. A third category will be listed along with male and female on census forms. Those with albinism will also be recognised for the first time. The aim of the census is to determine population, living conditions and ethnic composition to inform resource allocation. Individuals and policymakers alike see this as a huge step towards inclusion. The BBC's Rhoda Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
When James Karanja was born in 1991, the boxes on his birth certificate designating gender were left unmarked.
When I went to the hospital, I stayed for 3 weeks again because the doctors could not, with an immediate effect, tell whether I was a male or female. And that is how I came to be raised as Meru Aithera, just because they believed if I was raised as a girl, then I would be able to hide, you know, my parts.
James was born intersex. Someone who is born with a sexual anatomy that doesn't fit the typical definitions of male or female. He says he struggles to fit into what society terms as normal.
Most of the time when I'm asked to introduce myself, I'm always in a dilemma. What do people really want? Because I've been raised for the last 18 years as Meru Aithera, and I'm also James Karanja. So on my left is Meru Aithera, on my right is James Karanja.
Human rights lawyer John Chigiti says one of the aims of the new census category is to promote and protect intersex individuals' rights.
Indeed, it's a milestone because not only does it tell us that we recognize you, we're also telling them we need to know how many you are, where you live, your conditions in life, and the importance of that is that there is inclusion.
Usually conducted after each decade, this will be Kenya's sixth population census since independence. The data collected will be captured using tablets and transmitted to the server in real time. The Director General of the Bureau of Statistics, Zachary Mwangi, says it's important that intersex persons take part in the data collection process, which he says will allow for targeted policy making.
Our constitution is very much inclusive, ensuring that nobody is also left behind, such that we'll know the number of intersex, we also know their socio-economic characteristics, mm-hmm. we know their demographics, mm-hmm. where they are they in school, where they are employed. And this is key because if there is special interventions that should be targeted mm-hmm. to that particular group, then we'll have accurate data which can help in making informed decisions.
Another group to be recognized in the census for the first time this year are people living with albinism. The Albinism Society of Kenya has termed this as an important milestone. About 170 enumerators in bright orange vests have been walking door to door across the country of more than 40 million inhabitants. The massive and groundbreaking exercise, slated to end on the 31st of August, with preliminary findings released in 3 months' time and a detailed report within a year.
Rhoda Odhiambo. From time to time, big companies embark on well-meaning, positive product launches and advertising campaigns and are roundly mocked for it. The chocolate company Cadbury's has launched a new product in India called the Unity Bar. It's intended as a celebration of diversity. It's made up of rows of white, milk, blended and dark chocolate with a wrapper featuring people of different skin colours holding hands. But some critics say it's trivialising a serious issue. Stephanie Prentice told us more.
What's really come across in the reaction to this is that people don't like something as big as racism being tackled by something as small as a chocolate bar. So there's been a lot of tweets. Some of my favourites have included, the caste system isn't going to be dismantled through chocolate, lol.
And lol meaning laugh out loud.
Laugh out loud, yeah.
Lots of love, yes.
The
okay.
youths. And I have a dream that my children will not be judged by the colour of their chocolate, but by the content of their filling. So the structure of the bar is also being criticised. Some are asking why the white chocolate is in fact at the top and the dark at the bottom. And someone else pointed out that this, if this is all about unity, why are the rows of chocolate segregated by colour? Now, I've been speaking to people within the industry this afternoon, and one of them, David Grinner from Adweek, did point out that the idea was created for the market in India and that sometimes ideas don't travel well beyond borders. But he did also say that it would be ridiculous to think a multicoloured chocolate bar could address an issue as complex and serious as racial inequality.
So there have also always been other brands that do this sort of thing, despite being criticised. Do campaigns like this sometimes have a positive impact?
Well, there have been other high-profile brands which have kind of failed in pushing a racially aware agenda, like the Pepsi Black Lives Matter advert, but they can sometimes be praised for opening up cultural debates. Let's listen to a couple of experts I spoke to. We'll start with Simon Gwynn. He works for Campaign Magazine in London.
I don't think it's often a case of a single ad, for example, or a product launch, but it's a gradual shift in messaging, which has to be repeated and reinforced over and over again. You sometimes have a shift in what's called the Overton window, which is the set of acceptable mainstream ideas. So I think that the role that brands can play, it can actually be very powerful.
Dialogue is great. My question is always, are we as companies and our leaders opening up the right kind of dialogue and not having it derailed? What I see on Twitter in this case is skepticism and cynicism, not any kind of, okay, well, let's at least have the conversation, because it's not quite clear what the conversation should be either, really.
And that was Shireen Pathak from DigiDay in the US.
That was Stephanie Prentice. Job description, Napoleon Bonaparte impersonator, ideal candidate, well-presented male. Main duties include dressing up like the famous French statesman and military leader, and the ability to engage with individuals at all levels, especially dignitaries. Costume provided. That's a real job advert for one of the world's most remote islands, St Helena, in the South Atlantic. It was here that Napoleon was exiled after his defeat at Waterloo in 1815. If interested, contact the St Helena Tourist Office or have a listen to our correspondent Richard Galpin for more information.
Presumably, the ideal candidate would be fairly short. Napoleon was about 5'5", and with a penchant for wearing white breeches and a bicorn hat. But according to the St Helena Tourism Office, this will be a serious job. The successful applicant will be required to play the role of the former Emperor of France for at least the next 2 years, 2021 being the 200-year anniversary of Napoleon's death on the island. The job advert has other important requirements: that the impersonator would act as an ambassador for St Helena, be well presented and able to engage with all sorts of people, particularly dignitaries. Those submitting applications will be able to try on a replica of Napoleon's uniform. But there'll be no salary, just occasionally some expenses, and the job will be part-time. The expectation is that a local resident will be appointed to the position. The small volcanic British Overseas Territory lies in the South Atlantic. The nearest mainland is the west coast of Africa.
That's Richard Galpin, who also looks good in breeches and a bicorn hat, but he's too tall. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.